We're going to read from a couple of places in the Bible today. We're going to read from one spot right at the beginning and one spot quite near to the end. So we're going to go to Exodus chapter 12 and Luke chapter 22. So you might need fingers in both ends of the Bible. Do we have spare Bibles at the back? Maybe. If you don't have a Bible, you can go up the back and you might get lucky. I don't know. Otherwise, I'm sure you've got a phone and you can Google Exodus 12 and you'll find it. So the reason we're looking at those two places in the Bible, one at the start, one at the end, is that we're looking at, we're going to look at firstly, back when God's people were slaves to Pharaoh in Egypt. They were trapped there and they needed to be rescued. On the night that God rescued his people from Egypt, he set up a celebration so that his people would always remember how they had been saved from Egypt. So we're going to read about that first in Exodus, and then we're going to go forward to Luke, where we see how Jesus sets up a new night for us, a new thing for us before he saved us at the cross. So let's start in Exodus chapter 12, and we're going to read verses 1 to 11. The Lord said to Moses and Aaron in Egypt, "This month is to be for you the first month of your year. Tell the whole community of Israel that on the 10th day of this month, each man is to take a lamb for his family, one for each household. If any household is too small for a whole lamb, they must share one with their nearest neighbor, having taken into account the number of people there are. You are to determine the amount of lamb needed in accordance with what each person will eat. The animals you choose must be year-old males without defect, and you may take them from the sheep or the goats. Take care of them until the 14th day of the month, when all the members of the community of Israel must slaughter them at twilight. Then they are to take some of the blood and put it on the sides and tops of the door frames of the houses where they eat the lambs. That same night, they are to eat the meat roasted over the fire, along with bitter herbs and bread made without yeast. Do not eat the meat raw or boiled in water, but roast it over a fire with the head, legs, and internal organs. Do not leave any of it till morning. If some is left till morning, you must burn it. This is how you are to eat it, with your cloak tucked into your belt, your sandals on your feet, and your staff in your hand. Eat it in haste. It is the Lord's Passover." So that's the celebration that God set up to remind the people of how they were saved from Egypt. Now we go to Luke chapter 22, and we see what Jesus set up for us the night before he saved us at the cross. So this is Luke 22, verses 14 to 20. When the hour came, Jesus and his apostles reclined at the table, and he said to them, "I have eagerly desired to eat this Passover with you before I suffer. For I tell you, I will not eat it again until it finds fulfillment in the kingdom of God." After taking the cup, he gave thanks and said, "Take this and divide it among you. For I tell you, I will not drink again from the fruit of the vine until the kingdom of God comes." And he took the bread, gave thanks and broke it, and gave it to them, saying, "This is my body given for you. Do this in remembrance of me." In the same way, after the supper, he took the cup, saying, "This cup is the new covenant in my blood, which is poured out for you."
Well, good morning. My name's Ashley. I'm going to be opening up some of those passages. Today's going to be different. We're going to jump around a little bit. We're not going to go verse by verse as we often do. And what we're going to do is today at the end of the service, we're going to have our communion service. So we'll share some bread and juice at the end of today, which is unusual. If you've been here for a while, you know we usually do it before we send the kids out. But today we're going to look at the Passover, and then we're going to go from the Passover to what Jesus does at a Passover in creating what we now call communion or the Lord's Supper. And then we're going to have a look at that, and we're going to go and do it together. But before, I'm going to look at the Passover, we're going to look at communion, but I'm going to start somewhere further back. Not in time, but in thinking. We're going to start with the idea of Anzac Day. And the reason I'm doing that is because I think, I'm not going to promote or demote Anzac Day as a particular, but I think there's some things, just as an observer of how people work, that we can learn from Anzac Day that will help us understand the Passover, that will help us understand communion better. Okay, so that's a journey. Anzac Day, to understand the Passover, to understand communion. You wouldn't need to do this if you'd grown up in a Jewish family and spent your whole life every year celebrating Passover, but I don't think there's many of us here who've done that. We're going to make some progress in doing a Passover this Wednesday night. I'd love you to come along, but I reckon for not all of us, but some of us will have some idea of an Anzac Day. We're going to milk that for some understanding and going to move to Passover, move to communion. All right, let's do it in that order. So a month from now is Anzac Day. If you're not aware, it's the day that Aussies and New Zealanders remember going to war in 1915. But it's become much more than that. It's a day. Can I just check? Am I on? Cool. I am. Cool. I can't hear a thing. That's cool. For 100 years since then, it's been more than just a remembrance of that one particular battle in Gallipoli. It's become a memorial, a remembrance day for every major war that Australians have been in. It's become, I reckon, a culture-defining Memorial Day for Australians. Not for everyone. Some people are against it, and some just don't get it. Many have come to the country long since then and don't have a granddad or a great-grandfather who went and fought in these wars. But for many Aussies, it's the day that gets taught about in primary schools. It gets parades in its street. It gets its own biscuit, right? Great biscuits, Anzac Bickies. If you've never tried one, like that's a thing to do while you're here in Australia. And I think it has done so, but with all these things, I think it's done so well as a culture-defining thing. I reckon it's done so well because it does three things really well. One thing is it reunites us, okay? It reunites us. It causes a shared identity. It makes us remember our history. And because I'm scratching at this point for another thing that starts with R, I'm going to say it redirects us. It shapes how we look towards the future. I'm going to just work with that framework, everything we do in Anzac Day, Communion, and Passover, just to get us thinking. So it's something that unites us or reunites us. It makes us remember our history, and it redirects us. Let me just sort of play in that space with Anzac Day for a bit. Let me show you what I mean. Anzac Day creates a unity of people who get on board with it. Now, in the first place, if you were one of those returned soldiers, like if you had been to war and you survived and you came home, you'd have like an automatic unity with those you'd shared the trenches with. Even if they weren't in your division, if they were posted somewhere else, just the fact that you'd both been at war would give you an automatic unity. There'd be this shared identity. It'd be such an extreme experience that you'd forge this identity that would stick with you even as you come home and get back on with regular day-to-day life. But Anzac Day has been done in such a way that it's not just for the people who were there. But if you go along to Anzac Day services, you get invited to come and share as if you were there. You get to be a part of it. You get to kind of share in their identity. So Anzac Day services, they put this idea of mateship up there. I don't know where else you ever heard the word mateship. But you go to an Anzac service and it's all about mateship. And it's up there as one of the core values. And if you get on board with mateship, you're getting on board with the Anzac spirit. And a good Anzac Day service will always draw you into that sense of mateship. And there's something special about standing, possibly in the rain before dawn, with a bunch of total strangers. Like, and the heavier the rain, the more automatic and shared that idea of camaraderie is. You get this automatic and mateship. We're the guys who turned up in the rain before dawn. Maybe not quite the same as being in the trenches, but there's something of unity there. Now, I think, from what I'm told, in the 60s to the 70s and 80s, last century, Anzac services took a big plummet just because people really didn't want war to be our defining thing. They're sort of pushing back against that idea that war would be the thing that we get our identity in. And particularly in the last 10 years as well, there's been another sharp drop in Anzac Day services. I wonder if it's just that we're just getting in time far enough away that now less and less of us have a grandfather or even a great-grandfather to tell us about their experience of those wars. Maybe it's just the time. Maybe it's just as time goes on, more people have come in from other countries and just don't have that same connection. But however you come out of Anzac Day ceremonies aren't quite what they once were. But I don't think there's anything else that's taken its place quite so clearly. It's still the thing that turns up in the schools. It's still the thing that Australian politicians will get up and say, this is what defines us. So Anzac Day creates a unity and draws others into it. Anzac Day is also pretty good at making us remember what happened. Now, I've never studied history at all, certainly not Australian war history, but just by being in Australia for 40 years, I reckon I could probably bumble out a bit of an explanation on what happened in Gallipoli on April 25th, 1915, just because I've heard the story told every year. Through no effort, just by it being repeated every year, I, and if you're like me, could probably bumble out at least the main details of the story. And, maybe I could sort of work out how to make the sounds of the last postage, all the little elements that go into a service, you could kind of do it just because you were there every year through no effort of trying to study it. Now, of course, if you were actually in the war, if you were there, you would have experienced it in a totally different way. You would be able to retell the stories in a personal way. You'd remember the sounds of the bullets whizzing by. You'd remember the sound of maybe the one that took your mate in the trenches. You could, when you get together with others, you'd probably spend, if you're not closed in about it, but if you could easily spend hours and hours all day and all night retelling the stories of exactly what happened. Every year you would retell the same stories again and again because they were just such a core thing that formed your identity. But those of us who were never in the trenches, we get drawn into it with the poetry and the personal accounts of life in the trenches. That's what they do at Anzac Day. I think that's what's made it this identifying thing. But I reckon Anzac Day is more than that. Because for it to become what it's become, it can't just form unity and cause us to remember the past. It's had to redirect us and make us take something from that and let us shape our future. It's needed to be something that takes a shared identity and the remembering and tells us what we're going to be in the future. It's a thing that, we don't want it to be that it's we glorify war. And it's not that we're taking the thing and bearing grudges against people who have come from other countries that at one point we were at war with. But every year what they do is they take this idea of mateship and self-sacrifice and a few other things like that, and they say that's the thing that we're going to be going forward. They take that idea and say this is who we are going forward. So that even if you and me had granddads who were once at war, because they redirect it towards mateship and self-sacrifice, people from different countries can come and get on board with this idea, and you can say that's what it means to be Australian, or that's what it means to have the Anzac spirit, and you get on board. And I reckon it's those three things put together that have made Anzac kind of the defining day in Australian culture. Even for Aussies who don't believe in any sort of God, Anzac Day kind of becomes something like a sacred event. Now, you might have that experience already. You might be thinking, what is he going on about this Anzac thing? I've never heard of it before. But I reckon it's probably the key thing like that. Now, you imagine if one day you're at an Anzac Day service and you're standing out there before dawn and the service leader gets up and you expect him to start retelling the story of Gallipoli and he says, from now on, you won't remember Gallipoli. From now on, from this day on, you will remember me. When you lay wreaths, you will lay them now to monuments with my name on it, to statues of me. When your armed forces march in the morning, they're going to march along with bands that are playing songs about me. When you get up early to retell the stories, you're going to be retelling stories about what I am about to do. Your children in schools will colour in pictures of me. They'll hold special assemblies in the basketball court. They'll have a minute of silence to remember me. When you grab your sponsored bacon and egg burger after the service, you'll eat in a way that causes you to remember me. And when you say, lest we forget, you'll be making sure that you don't forget me. Imagine the leader of an Anzac Day service getting up and saying, from now on, the thing that binds you together and shapes your future will be me. Now, if your service leader at your local RSL got up and did that, he'd probably get lynched. Lynching isn't even a particularly Australian thing, so maybe we'd come up with something else. Maybe we'd fire a cannon at him. There's always these cannons around at Anzac Day services. Maybe one of them works. You'd find the guy and you'd fire a cannon at him, and that would, you find some way to cancel him, right? And that would be the thing that then becomes part of your story. You'd remember you were there, you took out the guy who thought that he could make Anzac Day about himself. And that would be a defining moment in our history. You'd retell the stories and warn future generations you don't mess with Anzac Day. Now, if we could imagine just the horror of someone getting up at Anzac Day and saying, this is now about me, imagine how the Jews must have felt when Jesus comes into the Passover and says, this is now about me. For Israel, for the Jews, the Passover was their defining celebration. It did for them what Anzac Day does for many Australians. It would give them an identity. This is who we are. We're a nation of mateship and self-sacrifice. But for the Jews, they say that we're a nation who... The thing that defines us is we got rescued out of Egypt by God. That's what makes us a people. Doesn't matter what nation we're in, doesn't matter if we're in exile or not. The thing that defines us is that we were once rescued by God. It gives us that shared identity. They remember, they look back to what happened, and they shape their calendar around it, and they look forward to the future of all the God's promises that are still yet to come. Now, after about 100 years, Gallipoli... 100 years after Gallipoli, Anzac Day is sort of slipping in our cultural thought, right? But Passover for Jews had lasted more than 1,000 years by the time Jesus comes on the scene, and there are still many Jews today who are doing the Passover. Compared to Anzac Day, Passover has lasted for ages. Now, according to the ancient text that we have from around Jesus' day, I'm going to do a bit of a different thing. I'm going to pull up some translations of texts that were around about Jesus' time, but they're not actually from the Bible. And we'll do a bit more of that on Wednesday when we do the Passover. You can sort of get a feel for how they have celebrated the Passover. One of the lines that they say is that in every generation, a person, they'll get up and say this at the Passover, in every generation, a person is obligated to regard himself as if he had come out of Egypt. As it is said, and this is quoting a part of the Bible, you shall tell your child on that day, it is because of this that the Lord did for me when I left Egypt. And they'll say things like, the Holy One, blessed be He, redeemed not only our fathers from Egypt, but He redeemed also us with them. As it is said, it was us that He brought out from there, so that He might bring us to give us the land that He swore to our fathers. Okay, so hear them pulling themselves into the identity of the people who've been saved out of Egypt, even 1,000 years later. Passover was way bigger for the Jews than Anzac Day is for Aussies today. Passover shaped their whole identity. Today, I reckon there's no politician, I don't think there'd be a politician, that would dare risk messing with Anzac Day. But Jesus got up in the Passover and said, this is now about me. Even from an evidence point of view, like if you didn't believe in God at all, you'd have to look at the history and the documents you can find about the first few centuries of Christianity and just see how the early church was mostly made up of Jews at first and they stopped celebrating the Passover. Even if you didn't believe anything about God, you'd have to look at that and say, how do you explain that? How do you explain this massive Jews that stopped celebrating the Passover and changed it to something else? Something seismic must have happened in history to cause that. And I reckon you end up finding the easiest explanation is to say that actually God came to earth and His Son, Jesus, and died on the cross to pay for sins and rose again. It would take something of that size to mess with Passover. Today there are many Jews that don't believe it and do treat it as blasphemous that Jesus would stand up and say that the Passover is about Him. But as Christians, we're ones who believe that Jesus actually came and saved us. There's another point in the Passover where an elder gets up and says something like, this is the bread of affliction that our fathers ate in the land of Egypt. It's at a point like that that Jesus gets up and says, this bread is my body. It's not going to be the bread of affliction anymore. Now it's my body that will suffer and you're going to have bread to remember me. Tomorrow my body is going to be broken for you and shared for you just as I break this bread and share it among you. Now Jesus is not saying that the bread is literally His body, just like the elder in the Passover is not saying that this bit of bread is literally the bread that our forefathers ate 1,500 years ago, right? He's not saying that. But the bread of suffering has been an invitation to relive the slavery for every generation of Jews, to relive the slavery of their ancestors so they can relive God saving them. And then after 1,000 years, more than 1,000 years of tradition, Jesus says, from now on, you hold up this bread, you remember my body and my suffering. You come and share in me. during the Passover several times, an elder gets up and holds up a cup of wine and uses it to honor God, who gives life and gives every good thing. And he says, "Blessed are you, Lord our God, King of the universe, who creates the fruit of the vine." But Jesus holds up the cup and he said, "Okay, now this is my blood, which is poured out for your forgiveness. This wine is a new covenant. This represents my dying in your place, so you can come into the eternal feast in the presence of the God who causes vines to grow." Now, some people will say Jesus never claimed to be God, and maybe he never said the exact sentence, "I am God." But the way he claims authority in the Passover to take something that God had commanded and had stayed with them for 1,500 years, the way he claims that, it's either that he's insane and deserves to be crucified, or that he is God to be worshipped. Like I say, Jews today will say he's the blasphemer who deserves to be crucified, and will say, "Hey, he's actually the Lord of it all." And we today make it all about Jesus. But to understand Jesus better and to know how to celebrate the Lord's Supper or communion, we'll do well to understand what was going on in that Passover that points us to Jesus and which Jesus claimed for himself. So that's why this coming Wednesday, we're going to explore the Passover. I'd love you to come. I'll keep saying that. This morning, I just want to sort of flag those three things that we notice observing in Anzac Day and see actually the same three things work in the Passover, and they're going to work in our communion services as well. The way the Passover reunites the community with a common identity, the way the Passover remembers the past and what God has done to give them that identity, and the way the Passover points them to the future and redirects their eyes to who they're going to be into the future. That framework's going to help us in communion unite better, remember better, and look forward better about why we come to the Lord's table. So let's think about just swimming this a little bit more. How do we create that unity? Well, the Passover, it was this fixed thing in the calendar. Everyone had to do it once a year. The calendar was based around it, and it forced you to reconnect with family groups. It forced you to relive the event of God rescuing their ancestors, and you had to consider yourself to be one of them. You had to become this identity of you're going to be a nation that's not defined by winning a war, not defined by losing a war, not defined by where you live. Even as they get kicked out of the land, they're defined by God saving them. You get the same focus when we share communion later today. 1 Corinthians 10 will tell us that there's one Christ who saved us, and we represent this by sharing one loaf of bread. It's cut up into little bits, but it comes from the one loaf, because there's one loaf. We, who are many, are one body. This is our unity. In 1 Corinthians 11, Paul's got a lot of issues with the Corinthian church, but in 1 Corinthians 11, one of the major issues that he deals with is how they're running the communion, how they're running the Lord's Supper. And for them in the early Corinthian church, it wasn't a little scrap of bread and a little cup of juice. It was a meal. It's not something that takes just a few minutes. It's something, a meal that would take a big chunk of time. They'd have a real meal and they'd share this as part of it. And in the Corinthian church, there was just such a range of wealth and freedom that some people could take the whole day off and turn up early with lots of food and have a feast and wine and drink away. And others might have been slaves who could only turn up later afterwards, and they couldn't bring any food, so they'd sort of go hungry. And so what was happening was the differences in the society were being brought into the church. The rich got to still relax and feast and get drunk, and the poor could not. And so they didn't kind of look the same. They didn't look like they had this shared identity. And Paul says, this is a disaster. This is like the worst thing you could be doing. In the whole letter Paul writes to the Corinthians, he's got all these issues. And all the time he's saying, well, you've kind of got this right. Yes, you're right. The body is not too important. But on the other hand, I think you shouldn't be using the body for prostitution. All right. And so he's going back. Yes, you kind of got this thing right. But actually, you're wrong about this. It goes back and forth. Read what he gets when he gets to communion, what he says when he gets to communion. 1 Corinthians 11, the whole time, so, oh, you got this right, but actually you got this wrong. He says, in the following directives, 1 Corinthians 11:17, in the following directives, I have no praise for you. Your meetings do more harm than good. He says, when you guys come together, it's not the Lord's Supper you eat. For when you are eating, some of you go ahead with your own private suppers. As a result, one person remains hungry, another gets drunk. He says, don't you have homes to eat and drink in? Like, it's not about the whole feast. Like, if you're getting hungry, just eat at home. Or do you despise the church of God by humiliating those who have nothing? What shall I say to you? Shall I praise you? He's had a praise for them on everything else. He says, certainly not in this matter. The way we do communion should forge a unity, a common identity between us. In communion, when we share the Lord's Supper, we're reflecting inwardly, yes. We're looking up at God, yes. But we must be a church that looks sideways to those around us. As you share bread and juice today, I want you to be forming a common identity in Jesus. And that should be the defining identity of our lives. When you think of yourself, you don't think of yourself as a man or a woman or a dad or a rich or a poor. Or you don't think of yourself as an Australian or as anything else. When you think, who am I? You think, I am a member of Jesus' body. I am one of this community that is defined by Jesus' death on the cross. Let that be our tribe. Let our communion services help build that. And then instead of letting, you know, there's differences between us in the world. Instead of letting that flow into the church, like was happening in the Corinthian church, you want the unity that we have at the Lord's table, at the foot of the cross, you want that unity to then flow outwards into how we live our lives in the world in the rest of the week. If there's differences in our wealth and our status out there, rather than that flow in here, we want actually our unity here to flow outwards and affect everything we do, the way you relate to people that you wouldn't otherwise relate to, the way you serve with your time and your money and your talents and your energy. It will all be shaped by the unity we have in here. Everything out there will be affected by the unity we have in here. But all of that hinges on us remembering the key thing that happened, remembering what Jesus has done for us all at the cross. Just as Anzac Day hinged on remembering certain historical events, and the Passover hinged on remembering the saving from Exodus, Jesus is saying, look, this supper is going to hinge on you remembering that I die to pay your sins. Luke 22, verse 19, Jesus says, this is my body given for you. Do this in remembrance of me. Now, you shouldn't need a special tradition to remember the day that the Son of God died on a cross to pay for sins. Like, that should be memorable enough. But if you've been Christian long enough, you know we tend to be pretty forgetful. Day by day, we forget who we are. Day by day, we find ourselves going down old paths, harboring, feeding sins that just don't reflect who we are in Jesus. So Jesus has given us this thing to remind us. And I know that it's pretty easy, if you do it the same way every time, for bread and juice to be shared in a way, if it's always the same, it sort of tends towards ritual and ceremony. There's always a danger in any ceremony that we'll go onto autopilot and do it without thinking. But you start to see the value of it as soon as you stop it. With the Passover, you can read in the Old Testament, there's times where people, God's people, were given the Passover, doing the Passover, and they're just sort of slowly drifting away and worshipping other gods from other nations, sort of getting tired of the same old God, worshipping other gods, worshipping idols, and they just sort of bit by bit stop doing the Passover. And things just go from bad to worse, and they drift further and further away. And then you get a character like Hezekiah, and Josiah is similar to this, but I'm going to pick on Hezekiah. He does this big thing, he restarts the Passover. You can go enjoy this later. Read 2 Chronicles chapter 30, and there's all the logistical challenges because they're just not set up, they're not used to doing the Passover. But he makes it happen in 2 Chronicles chapter 30. And then once they've done it, there's like this revival. People come back as they're walking home in Chronicles chapter 31, as people are walking home, they start smashing up idols on the way home. There's this Passover, they've had a revival, they've remembered who they are. And these people, they say, we're now a people who are defined by God, saved us. We don't need these other gods, we don't need these other idols, we don't need this sin in our life anymore. Can you imagine if that happened today? I hope this never happens, but just imagine. It's what, 2024 now? Imagine something happens and Southern Christian Church just stops celebrating the Passover. Okay, stop celebrating communion. We stop focusing every service on Jesus' death and the resurrection, and we sort of let all the things from our culture, the idols that our culture makes, all the things our culture teaches, we let them come in, and our church community sort of gets shaped by that. Now imagine that goes on for 60 years, which means if you're like 10 or 11 now, okay, then by the 2084. You're what? You're in your 70s now. If you're a teenager now, you're in your 70s 60 years from now. Scary thought. But God willing, you'll get there. And imagine in 2084, Southern employs a new pastor. I expect that I'll be dead by then. But imagine 2084 employs a new pastor, and the pastor sends out a TikTok, which will be old school by then. Okay, TikTok will be like only what your granddad uses. And sends out a TikTok announcing that this week at church, we're going to do communion for the first time in 60 years. Now, most of us will be passed on by then. But imagine the teenagers go, we haven't done communion in 60 years. I have this memory of what it was like. And imagine the excitement, actually, we're going to actually do communion once again. This is what it must have been like in Hezekiah's day. People hadn't done it for decades, and they come and do it, and there's this excitement about it, those who remember it. Although many people have grown up never doing it. Imagine, so you're a teenager now, you're now in your 70s, and you're remembering, we're going to do that. And you see the little cups being filled up and the bread being chopped up, and you go, we're going to share communion once again. And then after the service, people are going, it was kind of weird, wasn't it? What was that about? And the people who are teenagers now will be able to say around morning tea when they're in their 70s, no, the bread means this. It's about his body died on the cross. And it's the blood, the juice is like his blood. And there's this thing called forgiveness, which we haven't talked about in 60 years. And imagine the joy after not having done something like communion for 60 years. And then one day you do it again. And the telling about who Jesus is and what he's done comes back into our community. I hope that we don't have that 60-year gap. But imagine if we did have something like that. How awesome it would be to celebrate communion once again. Can I get you to imagine that joy and then bring that forward in time as we share communion this afternoon, or this morning? Right? As we, can you bring that and imagine if we had that gap of 60 years and then we came back to Jesus, awesome things would be happening by God's Spirit in our community. Can you bring that forward and say that is what is happening when we share communion now? We don't need to have the 60 years of wandering away. We're also in communion looking forward. Okay, we're looking forward to things that are coming. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 11, verse 26, for whenever you eat this bread and drink this cup, you proclaim the Lord's death until he comes. We say it all the time, but it assumes that you've got the idea that Jesus not just died, but rose and ascended, and he's going to come again for us, and that we ourselves are going to rise again from the dead. Either we're looking forward to him to come in our life, or expecting that even if our bodies die, he will raise us again. The idea of looking forward, it was always there in the Passover as well. Back in Exodus 12, verse 25, Moses is looking forward to the day when the nation is going to get brought into the promised land. And over the centuries, the Jews added to the Passover all the promises that God had made. The Passover, at the end of it, by the time Jesus comes around, includes a cup, which is for Elijah, because Malachi had promised that Elijah would come just before the Messiah comes. Whenever they were in exile, they always finished the Passover with a chant saying, next year in Jerusalem, next year in Jerusalem, next year we're going to come back to the promised land that God has promised us. We share the Lord's Supper looking forward to the day when Jesus returns to us. Now, we don't know when that'll be, but we know that we'll be ready. We're not going to be found worshipping some other idol. We're not going to be found in some sin on that day because we've been regularly reminding each other of who we are in Jesus' death. And we want to proclaim it to others who are not yet followers of Jesus as well. Paul seems to assume that in the Christian church, there will be others hanging around who don't yet follow Jesus. Now, different churches have done this in all sorts of ways through history. But we want to communicate to the visitor with us, this is who we are united in Jesus' death, and we'd love you to come and join us. His death is worth remembering. His death is worth being shaped by. So I reckon that means part of the Christian job is to bring people into our community. Not just for our communion services, but in every part of our lives. Be mixing your friends who don't know Jesus yet with your friends who do know Jesus. Let them see not just you, but the unity that we have. It's part of the witness that God has given us to help others come and find out about Jesus. If you're not yet a Christian here and you're here today, it's so great. You get to see that we are all about Jesus' death. It's the thing that binds us together, the things that gives us an identity and that we want to shape our lives around. We're not doing it perfectly, but I hope that you can see something of it shaping us. Can I invite you to bring people into your lives so that you can share with them not just the message about Jesus, but the visual aspect of our community proclaiming Jesus' death? All right, where have we been? For Aussie culture, Anzac Day is the thing, right? Even if it's slipping after 100 years, it's actually really hard today for anyone to say what it means to be an Australian. Like, how do you define the Anzac Day is the best thing most people have gone for? Even that kind of struggles. It's hard to say what is an Australian. For Jews, they knew exactly who they were. They were the people God had saved, waiting for him to finish his promises to them. And we know who we are. We know who we are more than an Australian knows what an Australian is. We're people who've been saved by Jesus' death on the cross. That's going to connect us more than anything else. It's lasted through thousands of years already. As Anzac Day is slipping after only 100 years, Christians are still sharing communion 2,000 years on, and I don't think it's going to slip anytime soon.